This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast for this week. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our Q&A with Layla, and we do this every week. We answer your listener questions. You can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And I'll mention that Layla is also available for consultation at the Hoffman Center, she's usually teams with me. We work together with patients who are medical patients at the Hoffman Center, but you can become a nutritional patient of Layla, and it also gives you a more economical pathway into the practice. And, you know, I got a call on the radio this Saturday, and the woman said, you know, I really love your show. I'm really interested in the stuff you have to say, but I tried to apply as a medical patient, and, you know, because you don't take insurance, I wasn't able to come. And I said, I'm sorry. And I wasn't on my toes enough to tell her, hey, you know, if you can't afford becoming a medical patient, or say you have a doctor and you're fine with your doctor and you just want some nutritional advice, they can come and see you. So check out drhoffman.com for information on how you can become a patient, or call the Hoffman Center, and you can be the beneficiary of the type of nutritional advice that you hear on this program by working with Layla. All right, so what's our next question, Layla?
Our next question, we've got an email from Alice. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Thank you for your wonderful shows. I just finished listening to Dr. Hoffman's podcast with Dr. Gilliams regarding immunity. My questions relate to the prolonged use of immune support supplements. I've been consistently using Empower for about 3 years now. And Alice is using Empower to eradicate the warts on her hands, which
right.
She has previously had to consistently burn off. It's worked very well.
Which is really interesting, you know, because here's something that's considered a dermatological condition. But when you
yeah.
support your immune system, your warts get better. I first noticed this, you know, I'll answer the question in a minute, but I first noticed this when
yeah.
I was giving intravenous vitamin C to a patient. I think she had chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia or something like that. And she's, you know, she came back after a series of treatments and she said, my fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue are better. And, oh, by the way, I noticed something completely unexpected. The warts on my hands have disappeared. So, you know, everybody is, you know, you shake hands with a million people, touch a lot of surfaces. Everybody is exposed to these warts. Why aren't we all covered
yeah.
with warts? It is not the virus, it's the terrain.
The
whether your skin and body are a hospitable soil in which a virus or bacteria or fungus can implant. So when you mm-hmm. support your immune system, this is one way to eradicate these types of problems without some kind of targeted magic bullet, you know, antiviral therapy, or, you know, burning, freezing, or using the scalpel mm-hmm. to remove these things, because, you know, it's like whack-a-mole with warts. You can cut them off, cut them off,
yeah.
cut them off. They just keep coming back if you don't have a good immune system. So anyway,
right.
go ahead.
Alice wants to know, should she stop using InPower unless more warts appear? And what do you think of NAC?
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and
so
should these supplements be used on an intravenous basis?
And this is controversial, because there are some people who argue that things that enhance immunity, like echinacea or Empower or transfer factor, should be used in a pulsatile fashion. In other words, take them for a while, then stop, so because the body might become over-revved. However, I don't personally believe that. And I take Empower on a daily basis at a moderate dose. I don't take like the, you know, 6 or 8 a day. I just take a couple a day just to fend off infections and to... as a bit of a bulwark against cancer, and I
mm-hmm.
think that that's
mm-hmm.
fine. There's been no demonstrable harmful effect, and so I think it's permissible
yeah.
to keep doing that. I mean, one can stop for the sake of economy and see if perhaps the warts don't come back. But, you know, it may be a measure of caution to take it prophylactically, preventively.
Is it the same for, and what about N-acetylcysteine?
Well, N-acetylcysteine, I think, is a good supplement to take. It builds glutathione, and that's a good thing. And I don't think that there's a downside in taking moderate doses of N-acetylcysteine because it's a glutathione precursor building block. We know that, back to biochemistry, what is glutathione? It's three amino acids, glycine, glutamine, and cysteine. It's a tripeptide. And N-acetylated cysteine, or NAC, has a way of getting into the system more readily than just ordinary. Otherwise, we just say take cysteine, L-cysteine. But the acetylation of the cysteine puts it into your system more more bioavailably.
Wow. So, Alice, thank you very much for your question. So glad that's worked out for you.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yay.
Okay. Yeah. Empower for warts.
Yeah, that's great. We're going to have to, tell people about that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We've got our next question is from Gabe. Is there any benefit to taking slow-release vitamin C since absorption of high doses of vitamin C is limited?
Okay.
Yeah, Dr. Hoffman, isn't it so that we only absorb, when we take it orally, vitamin C in doses of about 500 milligrams, and that's about it?
Yeah, I think the ceiling on it may be something around a gram, at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
This whole notion that, you wake up and you take, 10, 15, 20 grams of vitamin C, you won't, most of it's going to pass out, and you'll notice it because you'll get a laxative effect. So now, it's an appealing idea to take what's called time-release vitamin C because that means that it slowly releases. We know that it's to maintain high levels of vitamin C in your body, you have to take it frequently during the day. So this usual thing where people take something one twice daily may not cut it for vitamin C if you want to maintain high levels because you get two peaks and a couple of valleys in between. So it's best to dose vitamin C 4, 5, 6 times a day. I mean, I've seen absorption studies on vitamin C, and the best absorption is had when you take it anywhere from 4 to 6 times a day at around 500 to 1,000, but that's inconvenient.
Yeah.
So people say, well, it makes sense. Let me take one pill that slowly releases. The problem is that we don't have a reliable slow release system for vitamin C, and because it depends on the tableting or the enteric coating. Enteric coating means that you coat it with something that resists digestion. And there's people have variable peristalsis and transit time, and people have variable digestive strength. So for some people, that coating may not be enough, and the tablets break down quickly. And for another person, that tablet may not break down effectively at all and may go kerplunk in the toilet, worst case scenario.
Yeah.
So that's the problem with it. And then there's also ascorbyl palmitate, which is a more expensive form of seems to be fat soluble vitamin C. It's absorbed in a different way, and I have reserved judgment on that. I think this is sort of a fad. It's unclear to me if that obviates the problems with vitamin C and gets the vitamin C more effectively into the cells. I think it's one of those things that's touted without conclusive evidence. I'm not saying that it's bogus or that it's false, but it's a more expensive form of vitamin C. Vitamin C is a pretty cheap thing. It's a commoditized product. And, there's some notion that ester C may be more bioavailable. It's a more premium form of vitamin C. It's certainly easier on the stomach, so that's why I prescribe it.
I'd like to remind Gabe also that typically the bowel tolerance for oral vitamin C intake is generally, for many people, about 2,000 milligrams a day. And for those who are having a laxative effect, the advice would be just to build your tolerance up slowly so you could get to 4 to 5 to 6.
Right.
1,000 milligrams a day, which would be a good dose.
And, Linus Pauling was famous for advocating bowel tolerance vitamin C because the notion was you when your body needs it, you'll absorb it. And when your body doesn't need it, you'll get diarrhea from it. But I'm not sure that that's really been that well worked out, that, you know, some people with, you know, say someone has ulcerative colitis, they may need a lot of vitamin C, but you give those people a lot of pills, and especially something that, you know, has a threshold for creating diarrhea. And that, you know, so that's why when we have people who have trouble taking vitamin C orally and they need high doses, we give it to them intravenously. We give them vitamin C injections or IVs.
Yes.
And then we can get much higher levels. And that's a totally different effect, is we'll get very profound antiviral effects. We'll get
anti-cancer
effects from the higher doses that cannot be achieved through oral dosing.
If you feel like you're coming down with a cold, it's, you know, the immune drip, which contains vitamin C among other nutrients, is absolutely wonderful.
Which we offer at the Hoffman Center.
Gabe, thank you for your question. Okay. Oh, here we've got an email from Christy. Can you offer your opinion on whole food multis that seem to have a yeast basis, like, you know, those mega food type vitamins? Is the yeast base questionable even for someone without a yeast allergy or propensity to yeast infection?
Can you offer an opinion on that? You just wrote an article.
I just wrote an article about this. Or would you advise against these types of multivitamin supplements for everyone? Dr. Hoffman, remember nutritional yeast?
Yes.
That's
kind of an Adele Davis thing, you know, back in the 60s, right?
Right.
You know, you just take brewer's yeast, right?
And I think a lot of people still use it. I know some of our older patients are still putting some nutritional yeast into their smoothies or into their green drinks or something like that. And often these yeast flakes, because they have a cheesy, nutty flavor, vegans will use it as a food flavoring on things like popcorn, maybe even in soups and things like that. Well, I don't have any problem for somebody that doesn't have a problem with taking a yeast-based multi.
Right.
However, if you have candida, if you have candida overgrowth, if you're prone to yeast infections, if you have eczema, anything like that, it may not be the best source of nutrition or B vitamins for you. Typically, yeast is a source of B vitamins.
Right.
And on the other hand, a lot of whole foods-based vitamins have been come out, and, you know, they're very, very virtuous because it's more whole food-based, not made so much in a lab, et cetera, et cetera. However, for those of us with food allergies, this can be a real problem. If you're getting your bioflavonoids, your C for, or anything like that from certain fruits, say strawberries or something like that, and you're allergic, you're also going to react to that whole foods-based multi that you're taking. So this is a reason I'm not a big fan of whole foods-based multis, is we have too many patients and clients with food sensitivities that we have to take into consideration when advising on the type of multi.
Also, don't you find that the potencies are much lower generally with those?
It's very, very hard to gauge or to get into. I think it has to do with the extraction and the isolating, isolate, that it can, there will be more variability in those types of supplements. So,
and not just variability,
getting,
but also
just less.
You may not get
just
as
less.
Which, I mean, some people may say, well, less is more. Less is, it's a more subtle effect, and it's unnatural to give mega dosing. So that's a whole school of thought and a controversy within the field of nutrition. But to me, it represents, I don't know, sort of an alternative selling point, because there's like a million companies that offer vitamins, but when you put natural on them and say that your vitamins are superior to the, quote, synthetic vitamins, it may give you a competitive edge, and, you know, you can grab a bigger share of market or you can charge more.
Right. And, you know, the word natural, at least in the food industry, doesn't really mean that much, and it's not regulated in the food industry, not necessarily in the nutraceutical industry. I'm not quite sure, but so it's, So, Christy, thank you very much for that thoughtful question.
Sure.
All right. We have a question from May. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I'm an avid listener of your podcast. Thank you both for providing so much important information. I always find I learn something new, even when the subject matter doesn't pertain to me.
Right.
Keep up the great work. Thank you, May. Her question is about DGL. May says, after hearing you speak about DGL, I've been trying it for a few months for acid reflux. It seems to work somewhat, but not entirely. I've heard you say it's okay to take more than the dosage on the bottle, which is 3 per day. My question is, how much is too much? I've increased it to 5 or 6 per day. Also, if I take DGL prior to a meal, then I take my other supplements with that meal, am I blocking the absorption of those supplements?
Okay, you go
no,
on that.
You're not blocking the absorption.
Right.
You're absolutely not blocking the absorption. How much is too much? I don't know, Dr. Hoffman. More than 12, maybe?
Yeah, I didn't even know.
I don't know.
I didn't even know there's a limit. And I think one of the problems is that when people take DGL, they go, well, I took the DGL, doesn't work. Well, how many do you take? Well, I took, like it said in the body, I took one or two. You know, I took two a day. Well, I think a misconception is that every supplement on the sun should be taken one twice daily, and that would be convenient. But this is a supplement that you really need to continuously coat the stomach lining with, and or the esophagus with. And so if you do it a couple of times a day, you might get some protection, but you really want to get in there between meals, away from food, and continuously douse your esophageal or stomach mucosa with the protective substances that are in licorice. And the one theoretical obstacle, but it's not a practical obstacle, is that licorice raises blood pressure. But DGL is precisely called DGL because it's deglycerizinated. It's that they've taken out the glycyrrhizinic acid, which is responsible for high blood pressure. So you can go to town on that, whereas you can't if you were just to take regular licorice tea. You really shouldn't take like 12 cups of licorice tea. You'll get the protective effects in your gastrointestinal mucosa, but your blood pressure will soar. You will lose potassium, and it's dangerous. It's actually dangerous. But the DGL is got kind of, it's the defanged form of licorice where you're not going to get the adverse effects. So you can knock yourself out on that.
Yeah. And May, if you're suffering from acid reflux, might I also suggest taking some Endofen?
Yeah.
Endofen. If you go to drhoffman.com to the store, it's a powder, and the optimal dosage of Endofen is 2 level tablespoons and enough water for it to dissolve in twice a day in between your meals.
Very effective. Very effective.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, you know, there's for acid reflux, there's a certain diet to follow as well. You want to avoid chocolate, tomato products, coffees and teas, not because of their caffeine content, but because of their acid content.
Mm-hmm.
And certain other fruits or vegetables that may be problematic in their raw form. You probably want to consult with a nutritionist on that to make sure you're not overdoing it on some of these very refluxy foods.
Right. And what about the role of SIBO in creating that?
Oh, yes. SIBO can also cause some reflux. But here's the thing. The SIBO often comes after somebody has been treated for acid reflux or GERD with use of a medication like Prilosec or Nexium, a PPI.
Right.
Because by making the stomach, the intestine more alkaline, it sets you up for SIBO, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Which is why many people get relief from their upper GI symptoms, but then they start getting lower GI symptoms like diarrhea, urgency, irritable bowel, cramping, bloating, the disruption of the balance in bacteria in the intestinal tract results in small intestine bacterial proliferation or SIBO. And then you don't have a happy GI tract. So that's another problem associated with the PPIs. And lately we've also come across another one, which is that you have a higher risk of kidney failure if you take those medications. That's nasty.
Yes. Oh, boy. You know, I was just reading a study about the incidence in chronic kidney disease of late, maybe over the past 10 to 15 years, and it's so interesting that it's it's correlated with the use of such medications. So,
yeah, which has skyrocketed. There's probably, I don't know, 40, 50 million Americans taking those medications. It's unbelievable.
Well, here's the thing. But when they're prescribed, Dr. Hubb, you know, when they're prescribed, they're told to take it the rest of their lives when they shouldn't take it for probably more than 2 to 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, that's the problem. We have time for a quick question, if there's such thing.
A quick question. Let's see here. Okay, we've got one from David. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Thanks for providing this great service. About 18 months ago, a friend of mine was found to have very low vitamin D of 12.
Ooh.
His conventional MD told him to start taking 2,000 IU a day.
Right.
And
okay.
His latest number is 29.
Yeah.
His latest number is 29.
I know what he's going to ask. What does it take to get to normal? And I actually just shared a study on that with listeners. So maybe I've got that study handy.
There is another bit of important information here, Dr. Hoffman.
Sure. Yeah.
He's not taking more because he's concerned of taking a higher dose, which might adversely drive up his calcium level, which is currently on the high side of normal. What do you say to that?
Well, his calcium could be on the high side of normal precisely because his vitamin D is low. See, there's two conditions of high calcium, basically. There's secondary and primary hyperparathyroidism. Parathyroid is a gland that sits on top of the thyroid. In primary hyperparathyroidism, it's just that the parathyroid glands are going haywire and they're causing more PTH to be secreted, and that raises your absorption of calcium. Your calcium goes up, you have high blood calcium. So the treatment for that is to remove the parathyroid glands. But in secondary hyperparathyroidism, it's precisely because there's not enough vitamin D, and the parathyroid glands start working overtime to provide calcium to the bones because there's not enough vitamin D. And to increase the absorption of calcium. So your blood levels of calcium go up, but when you take more vitamin D, they go down again. So let me find the note on, I'm looking in my computer here. And I'm just going to find that study because it's very, very, very germane to this question. Is how much vitamin D do you need to take if you have a deficiency? It precisely targets that question. So
for a quick question, huh?
Yeah, I know. I'm gonna deal with that.
But wow, a level of 12.
Oh, here it is. Here it is.
And then taking.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. So, and this is a repeat because I did talk about it. If you listen to the podcast, I apologize for repeating it, but we did it over the weekend. So this is a study done in the journal Pediatrics, and it looked at adolescents who were primarily Hispanic and Black, who generally have a higher risk of vitamin D deficiency precisely because their skin is darker, they spend less time in the sun, or their skin is resistant to production of vitamin D because it's darker. Dark skin doesn't absorb the UV rays, which triggers vitamin D synthesis. So there's really an epidemic of vitamin D deficiency in these kids. And what they found was, this is an 8-week study, and they found a bunch of vitamin D deficient adolescents. They were average age 16, and their vitamin D was on the average 14. What did this guy say? It was 12?
12.
Okay, so very germane 14, to this thing.
Wow.
Okay, so then they said, okay, we're going to fix it, but they gave them three options. One was to take 1,000 IUs per day for 8 weeks. Another was to take 5,000 IUs per day. No, that wouldn't do much, and you'll see what happens. Another was to take 5,000 IUs per day for 8 weeks, also, and another was to take 50,000 IUs per week for 8 weeks. So that wasn't daily dosing, that was weekly dosing. So, but do the math, 50,000 divided by 7, that's about 7,000 a day. So you had three dosing regimens. So here's what happened. The average change in vitamin D levels among the three groups, when you took 1,000, it went up 6 points. So it didn't actually normalize because it was 14. Well, I guess it got to 20, okay, which is borderline.
That's still deficient.
So... with the 5,000, it went up 21 points, which would take it from 14 to 35, right? Which is mm-hmm. suboptimal, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's getting in the ballpark when you start taking 5,000 a day. And it's safe. And look, nobody overdosed, right? When you took 7,000 a day, which is 50,000 a week, it went up 25 points, which would put people in the normal range. So here, but here's the statistic that's interesting, is that with the 1,000 a day, only 2% achieved vitamin D sufficiency, which they define as 30 nanograms per ml. That's sufficiency.
Yeah.
And we would like to see it a little higher, but they said, okay, it's 30. That's good enough. Only 2%. So that wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. With 5,000, mm-hmm. over half, 56% did, but then again, 44% did not. And then with the even with the 50,000 once a week, 72% did, but that means that 28% didn't. And what they also found was that obese adolescents have poor responses to treatment and may need higher doses than non-obese use. This would also apply to adults because it's okay. So the fatter you are, the more vitamin D it takes. So doctor was wrong. Doctor's wrong on two counts because the guy's calcium is high, but he should have recognized that the guy's calcium is high, not creating a danger that taking vitamin D would make it higher, but actually the vitamin D should help to resolve the high calcium.
Yes.
And I have to say, I've had this argument a couple of times, not recently, because I think they're learning more about this, but even with nephrologists, even with endocrinologists, you know, very, very advanced trained physicians who said, well, I'm afraid to give the patient a higher dose of vitamin D. You're putting them on 5,000 international units. Are you sure you want to? And I said, yeah, this is my field. I know what I'm doing. And they had told the patient, oh, my goodness, Dr. Hoffman's giving you much too much vitamin D. Well, no. Turns out, I think we've won the argument on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Look at that. And even at 50,000 a week, which, you know, some people, frankly, are afraid of, and there's no reason to be because it only took care of the 70-some-odd percent of those people.
Right, yeah. And
For those people who wonder why an overweight, obese person needs more vitamin D is actually sequestered by fat cells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of hides in the fat. It hides in the fat.
Yeah.
So, all right. Yeah. Great. Okay, well, that's all the time that we have. It was a short question that turned into a long question, but forgive us for going over time. I think you may find that study edifying. I want to thank you for joining us today. I want to also remind you that when we talk supplements, you know, we talked earlier about Endofin. We talk about a variety of high-quality supplements during this program, and you can access them at drhoffman.com. Click on the store. We have a wide variety of the highest quality supplements at reasonable prices. You can shop around and price compare. We have a price match guarantee on the supplements that we sell. So you can thereby support these free podcasts. If you find them a useful educational resource, we'd love to get you to shop at drhoffman.com, and you'll also be the beneficiary of the highest quality supplements. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Layla. Have a great week.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'll see you in the
you
office.
Too.
And we'll be back next week with more Q&A with Layla, which you can find at drhoffman.com. Download us on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And this is Intelligent Medicine.